This is Arthur Mansfield, interviewed by Chris Alden Lee via Skype on the 28th of May 2013. Arthur Mansfield, Part 2.
Let's talk now, if we can, in some detail about your year at Signy. The most interesting factor from my point of view is that you suddenly became bass leader. What extra responsibilities did you take on board when you became bass leader at Signy?
Apart from making sure that the observations, the weather observations, were done and sent out on time, I personally took on the duty of supply, if you like. I did that at South Georgia, by the way. I took over all of the food supplies and equipment, and made sure that that side of things ran smoothly, as I did at Sydney. But the Met observers knew their job, so they got on with that without any fuss. But as did the radio operator and diesel mechanic. But I don't recall any particular problems in getting people to perform their own particular functions and to carry out others on behalf of the rest of us. Cooking, for instance, was a thing that we shared, and so once every 5 weeks, you spent a week as cook and doing, in fact, your other job as well as you could, in between making meals for the rest of us. I got out of that at one point by when I was working on the Weddell Seal by suggesting to the others that I did a double turn of cooking earlier on the season, and then I would miss a turn later on when I was doing the sealing work, and all agreed that this was fine. So, but other than that, everyone pitched in to, as far as I remember, to the best of their abilities. There was no particular lagging, hanging around doing nothing whilst others did all the hard work. I think everybody came, joined FIDS with that in mind, or they soon developed that mindset anyway, that we were a team. So
all this really gave you a bit more time at Signy to do your zoological work then. So can you expand a little on the kind of work you were doing with the Weddell Seals?
Well, first of all, I looked at their local behaviour, you know, time of haul out, and when they had their pups, and how long they suckled their pups for, and this sort of basic biological stuff, we needed seal meat for the dogs, and a bit for ourselves, and so I shot a fair number of Weddell seals, and a job, by the way, I didn't particularly like doing, even though Dick had taught me well that on the elephant seal, and I did it readily, but they're beautiful animals, and I hesitated to do that, and of course, if you I wanted a series of female reproductive organs from the time that they pupped until the pup had been weaned. And of course, if you when you kill a female seal with a 2-day-old pup, then you've got to kill the pup as well, which can't survive without its mother. So that was something that always struck me hard, but you can't find these things out unless you do that kind of thing. Yes, I've always felt that about killing large animals, but there you are. And I did get some good data, and of course we used the seals for feeding the dogs. We had 14, I think, to start with, and then a number of dogs got added to the population, but not many, curiously. The rate of survival of husky pups was very, very, very low.
Mm. Why was the seal research essential in your mind?
The elephant seal work, of course, was. The final result of his work in South Georgia was to solve the basic problem of what's the size of the population and how does it grow and how much of it can we usefully exploit. So that was the basis of his work. But of course, he did a much more extensive coverage and had an enormous number of samples from the catch of the whaling station. But mine was, I suppose, in a way, serendipity, if you like, that I was intrigued by these animals and I wanted to know more about them. I don't think it was essential, if you like, from the point of view of the survey or
it was essential in understanding how the Weddell seals operated, their life cycle and so on.
Yes, I wanted to expand on what we had known from information that Colin Bertram, for instance, wrote in one of his reports.
What happened to the samples then? If you took the seal, the female seal through its reproductive cycle, did you keep samples in glass jars, or what happened?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, I had. I had no formal statement about whether I could or could not do biological work. I mean, I wasn't employed as a biologist, so in fact, what I did was to I needed a certain amount of material to preserve specimens, I was fortunately able to get some of the surplus that Dick had at South Georgia and take it south with me to the South Orkneys. So I was able to preserve things like ovaries and parts of the uterus and so on of the females, and that was what enabled me to get useful information. But yes, it required pickling in jars of special preservative and getting them back to England for analysis.
What other species did you look at? I gather you did some work on prions and sheathbills.
Yes, have you been to Stickney, by the way?
Sadly not, no.
Well, behind the old base hut, there were crags going up quite fairly sharply, and there were nests of snow petrels, Cape pigeons, and the ones that intrigued me were the dove prions, the lovely blue and grey and plumage, and much like the British jays, by the way, that kind of blue and silver and so on. And when they were in their nests in rock crevices and in scree slopes and so on, you could hear this lovely cooing sound, which is what, of course, gave their name of dove prion. So that was very nice to hear them making their song in the evenings, after the sun had gone. But there wasn't that much darkness at that time of year anyway, at the latitude of Sydney.
And again, you were monitoring the year cycle.
Yes, we banded as many as we could. We marked their nests and banded them. And I got some returns, but I gather that people like Lance Tickell and who've worked subsequently on some of these birds have found quite a lot of useful information about their lifespan and their return to their traditional nesting site and so on and so forth. Just fascinating stuff. So, to a biologist, anyway.
And the sheathbills, again, was that to monitor their life cycle to see what they did with themselves?
That was more to, again, to see if, well, they, of course, they took off, all of them, and you never saw them for months. But where did the sheathbills go, since they're not essentially oceanic birds? It was nice to mark them, and we used a lot of the bird bands that Bill Sladen had left behind. And as far as I know, we used up every one that we could lay our hands on. And we did the same for skuas as well, wondering if these populations were well established because of their effect on those two species, their effect on the penguin colonies. And they were pretty pretty avid predators. They would swoop in, and the skuas particularly would pluck off a newborn chick. And the sheathbills were remarkable at aggravating the penguins, so they'd forget their egg for a moment, and the sheathbill would come in and stab an egg with its bill and fly off with this huge egg stuck on its bill. So they were quite serious predators too of penguins. Although there were lots of penguins, I must say.
the prion work seems to have been done in part, at least, in the dark, after darkfall.
We would search with flashlights if it got really dark, say it was clouded over and around midnight, and we would search them out with flashlights, but they would be again in their rock burrows or just at the entrance, so we were able to band quite a lot of them quite easily. I haven't been able to lay my hands on the reports on some of these species that have been written subsequently, but you've probably looked at them or have access to them, so I'm a bit rusty on this.
Don't worry about that. Don't worry about that. How much difference did having the dogs available to you make to your routine at Sydney compared to South Georgia?
Well, South Georgia, of course, they weren't our responsibility. They were the responsibility of the magistrate, and they were waiting there to be taken to the Norwegian, British, Swedish Antarctic expedition. But that, for some reason, fell through, and so they were there for the winter. But it was the magistrate's responsibility. That was Ken Pierce Butler, who was at Stonington, I think, in 1956 and 7. So we didn't have much to do with the dogs. But at Sydney, we had, of course, a tremendous amount to do with them. And I think they were a very valuable addition to the work at the base. It kept us all busy, and people could go and talk to their favorite dog if they were feeling a bit low. And we spent a lot of time not only feeding them and looking after them, but exercising them too. And we weren't able to gather more than a small team. I think we had a five dog team, mostly of young pups, and they worked very well eventually. And we used those for hauling the seal meat back to base from where we'd shot them on the ice, or there was a haul out of Weddell seals and elephant seals in across the bay, where we stashed, where we killed seals in the open water season and just before freeze up, and then cut them up in pieces and brought them back during the winter. So that was a use for dogs, but everybody, I think, liked having them around, and we would use some of them for ski joring, which you know, where you hook a long line onto a harness and take your ski poles in one hand and the harness and the line in the other, and go off with the dog, and that was very successful. I enjoyed doing that.
How far afield could you get with your dogs and sledges?
Well, we went across at Sydney. We went across to Normanna Strait and
Coronation Island.
To Coronation Island, and we did a number of trips like that. That was all potentially a bit dangerous because there were currents under the ice, sort of making it weak in places. Although I think we only had a few occasions where the sled broke through the ice or one of the dogs, but not to drag down the whole team. And I used a five dog team to go back and forwards across the island and do my work on the Weddell seals on the west coast. I set up a camp there, and.
Was it a steep learning curve to handle a five-dog team? I guess you'd never done that kind of thing before.
No. I guess we had to learn the hard way.
And when the sea ice went out, you took to the pram.
Yes.
How successful was boating?
Well, we had an old Seagull two-horsepower motor, which was a means of propulsion, but it was reasonably dependent. I don't remember that we ever got stuck, but it was the sort of thing that was chancy, and you didn't take it without a good pair of oars in case you got really stuck. And we set up a small supply of food across the strait and on Coronation Island, just in case we ever did get stuck. But I'm not sure whether we had a small radio that we could carry with us. I don't think we did, actually. Can't remember.
Did you ever have any scary moments with dogs or boats?
No, I can't. I can't recall any particularly. No, we were pretty careful, and apart from crossing the to Coronation, we didn't stray really far away from the coast at any time. Yeah. Although there was no real reason to do so anyway.
I think you had some trouble with the diesel engines in your year at Sydney, didn't you?
Yes, I remember. One of the problems was that they're extremely difficult to start if you don't have the right starting fluid, which is basically ether. And you can give a diesel engine a squirt of ether, even at very, very low temperatures, and the thing will bang and crack and then take off and work. But unfortunately, it was I was in charge of stores, and I realized this, that we looked in all the right boxes for a supply of starting fluid, which was in spray cans, but there was no sign of it in the appropriate boxes, and it didn't come to light until well after the deep freeze of winter. Tony Wilson, who is a diesel mechanic, he at the time he invented the system of soaking a rod wrapped with canvas, I think, and then soaked in methylated spirit, and then put underneath the air intake of the diesel, so that when you started winding it round and round and round and round, the air would be sucked in with a flame from this this sort of burning torch, and that seemed to work out quite satisfactorily. So, as far as I know, that was the only problem that I recall. Maybe we had problems with bearings, but
a shortage of lubricating oil, which resulted in some strict economy of use in the later part of the year of the generators.
Oh, that I don't remember.
Okay.
What report was that, by the way, you're reading from?
General Base Report, 1952, Part 2, Summary Continued.
Oh, well, I wrote the base report, but I certainly don't recall that. Was it?
Well, just out of interest, it is 60 years ago, don't worry. The shortage of lubricating oil has resulted in our exercising strict economy in the use of the generators in the latter part of the year. I would re-emphasise the need for a larger supply of oil consistent with a generous supply of diesel fuel. No new lubricating oil could be spared for the Seagull outboard motor this season, but a quantity of oil that had been contaminated with diesel fuel was used with great success.
And that perfectly came from me.
Well, I would, yeah, sure. A.W. Mansfield, it says here.
Oh, it's not in a message to Phil, Stanley, is it?
No, it's a typed base report, end of the year base report. General Base Report, Part 2. Don't worry about it. You've given me the answer that I needed, which is absolutely fine. Yeah.
I've just got parts 3 and 4, but I don't remember part 2. Anyway.
Let me ask you about something else, sir, if I may. I've got a couple more questions, Arthur, then I think we can probably start wrapping it up.
Yeah.
Tell me about the water supply, because that also was a bit tricky at times, and some of your colleagues had to kind of invent a new supply.
It was tricky towards the end of the summer. There was a little dam which the whalers had built halfway up the hillside, and that could just collected sort of runoff from the hill, and that supplied us with water after the supply of ice had gone, because we used quite a lot of we used blocks of ice and snow as our water supply during the winter, but fresh water was short in supply, but there was a freshwater lake across the other side of the bay, which the sealers had built actually a pumping station there, and there was always the possibility of going across there and getting a supply, but that was a tedious job, but I don't recall it ever being a serious threat to our water supply at all.
The report says that Wurzwig and Johnson spent much time in tapping a water supply from the low boggy ground to the southeast of the hut. This has saved many weary hours of fetching in the daily water supply.
Yes, so Fred and Ron Wurzwig were up to all kinds of things, I think. But
do you think you left the Cygne base a better place than you found it?
That's a tough one. Well, people were doing different kinds of things. I mean, Bill Sladen, for instance, did an awful lot of penguin work there, and Dick, of course, with his elephant seal work. And I suppose we probably all like to think we added our bit to what the base had done, but as to the actual base itself,
yeah.
Is that what you mean, or?
Well, that as well. There's a new dark room. You've dealt with a leaking roof.
I remember Tony Wilson, the radio operator. He redid his radio room and really made quite a nice job of that. I think the dark room was the inside anyway, was done by John O'Hare. And John, of course, was a fit of much experience, having survived the burning down of the hut in 1949
at Hope Bay.
Sorry, 40, yeah.
49 at Hope Bay, yeah.
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 Okay.
So I think John did a lot of work on that.
There's one intriguing note here at the very bottom. It says, and I'll be interested to see whether you can remember much about this, I cannot with truthfulness say that this has been a completely happy year, for there has been some friction from time to time. This has slightly marred what otherwise should have been a most pleasant stay at Cygne. Do you remember the source of do you remember the nature of the friction?
I think inevitably there has to be a little. I can't believe that any of the bases would survive a whole year with people with widely differing experiences who would not sort of get on each other's nerves, or however you like to express it, occasionally. But yes, I must have felt there was the odd occasion of people being quite upset with someone else, but I don't think it festered, because we were all too busy with what we had to do, and maybe there is a reason for why dogs are such a useful addition to a base, where there's a lot of work involved with them, and as I say, they're companionable in the way that pets are, that you can go and talk to even a husky that's chained up and perhaps relieve some of your emotions.
Did you ever find yourself having to sort of step into any dispute or unease or unhappiness as base leader?
I think there was only one occasion that I recall where Fred and Tony had a very strong difference of opinion, but I can't say at this time what it was about, but that was diffused by the rest of us. So, I mean, it's not the sort of thing that I wrote down in a personal diary, if you like, but it's the sort of thing that perhaps was expected. But I remember one base member whom I shall not name had a had a reputation for drinking rather too much when he was in Stanley, and in fact I was warned by the captain of the Bisco that what had happened, and that I think he'd been in the jug in Stanley for a night. But we had a habit of on Saturday night, I think, of bringing out the bottles and having a drink. And on this occasion, I brought out the gin bottle, I think it was, and I took the other members of the base to one side and said, look, so-and-so has been having a problem in Stanley. I want us all to enjoy a Saturday evening drink, but I don't want so and so to get drunk. Upon which he will become rather annoying and in fact belligerent and probably assault somebody, which is what he did, of course, in Stanley. In whatever pub he was in. So everyone agreed, and if we brought the bottle out, we made sure that we drank the same amount as he did. And it never got to the point where he got obstreperous. But so that diffused that one. But on the way out when the ship left Sydney and took the other four members of the base out, the moment this fellow got into Stanley, no, I think they unwisely, when the ship called at South Georgia, they unwisely put some drink out there, and he imbibed too much and promptly assaulted one of the base members, and again later on in Stanley. So that was. So I think we dealt with that one quite effectively, but it was always a shame because he did his job and did it very well.
So when it came to leave the Antarctic, what were your feelings, Arthur? Had you had enough, or were you sorry to leave?
Oh, I think I was sorry to leave, I knew that I was going to be able to spend a pleasant few months in Cambridge working up the material, and I also had a 3 months stay in Harrow granted to me. That's the main Met Office station in England in Harrow. And so I went there and made use of all their archives to write that paper on the weather in the dependencies. So I was looking forward to those two things, and I had no particular knowledge of where things might lead in the future. But
well, you went on to form a long and successful career in Arctic Canada, and I'm just wondering how much those 2 years in the South shaped your future career.
Oh, a tremendous amount. When I saw the opportunity of getting a scholarship to McGill to work in the North, these scholarships were put out by the Carnegie Foundation, and in conjunction with the Arctic Institute of North America. And so one could apply, and as long as you found a place in a university, if you had some other experience, you were fairly sure of getting a grant. So I applied to McGill and with my background and said what I wanted to do. And it turned out that McGill had a very small but very effective group who were working in Northern Canada. And that was under a Max Dunbar, who was the professor of zoology at McGill at the time. And so he said, yes, we'll take you as a graduate student. So with that, I applied for one of these scholarships and got it. That enabled me to work in the north. And then, of course, traveling with the Inuit, which I did quite extensively, was easy for me because, I was used to the life, as it were, and used to dogs, and I got on well with the people I worked with, so that was fine. So it was a great help.
You spent a lot longer up north than you ever did down south, but what do you feel is the difference between the two poles? Is there a sort of a spiritual or atmospheric or environmental difference that you are aware of?
Oh, tremendous environmental difference in that the ice is there, yes, but in places where I work, like Northern Hudson's Bay, the ice goes in the summer, and you've got a long summer season where there's no ice or snow on the land, you take to the water much more readily than you did in the south. But there was still a lot of winter travel. I started my work in the north by traveling on the sea ice for several months before I was able to start the open water work when the ice was breaking up and going out.
So is it a different spirit then, comparing the north to the south? Is there a different spirit about the place?
Yeah, I'm not quite sure how to reply to that one.
Do you feel different in the two different environments?
Well, I was working by myself, for one thing, we're working with the Inuit, and which was a new experience. I mean, the first man I travelled extensively with didn't understand a word of English except tea, I recall, but we got on famously because he understood immediately when we started shooting seals and I would take specimens from them that I knew what I was doing, so he quite happily stayed back whilst I did my job, and then when I finished, he would come and do his job, which was to dismember the beast and then feed his huskies. And we usually travelled with a seven dog team. That seemed to be pretty well the standard, so that was an entirely different atmosphere, I lived in an old Hudson's Bay Company house, which was no longer used. A more modern one had been built, so that was my base, and that was different. And of course there were the people around who were responsible for the Inuit's well-being and also supplying them with stores. So that again was different.
When I interview FIDS, my final question usually is, how important were those years in the Antarctic in your life as a whole? And most FIDS, of course, say it was the most important time of my life. you've had a lot more experience of the Arctic, so I wonder whether your answer to that question might be different.
No, it wasn't the most important period, but it was it was a period when I gathered the experience and background that that I needed in later years. So in that sense, it was very important. But I guess the later years were just as important. Mm. I wouldn't say more so, but I certainly was glad that that I had that experience. As you see, it led to a different and long career, which was which made it so successful for me.
It's been a marvellous couple of hours, Arthur. I'm very grateful to you, and I really enjoyed talking to you. So thank you very much indeed.